Welcome to Mysterious Universe Plus, Season 21, Episode 22. Coming up on the show, we've got The Lost Art of Breath, Ancient Nose Hacks, and the Flying Saucer Chrono Weapons. I'm Benjamin Grundy, joining me is Aaron Wright.
What do you mean by nose hacks?
Nose hacks, weird ways of breathing that changes your brain, changes the way you think and messes with your body.
Oh, I mean, this is kind of like, what, the Wim Hof kind of thing that you change your breathing? Okay.
That's part of it. I remember I went on... It was a kind of a yoga treat with my wife years ago. We just wanted to get out of the city, and it happened to be a yoga retreat where they give you these yoga classes. We went to one of them, but it was essentially all these different breathing techniques where you're alternating which nostril.
Yeah, I've seen that.
You're breathing through.
Yeah.
And I always thought it was a bit silly, a little bit woo.
Yeah.
Even for me.
Yeah, well.
but no, this new book from James Nestor called Breath, The New Science of a Lost Art, goes into all this stuff. And it's absolutely fascinating. All the science behind it that's coming out over the last couple of years, the way that breathing can do incredible things like change the shape of your face.
You mean structurally?
You can structurally change the shape of your face. You can make your mouth grow bigger. You can add bone density from different methods.
Wow.
It's really, really fascinating. He talks about looking at ancient skulls and how different they were to modern humans in terms of the sinus cavities and how they breathed and how it affected their teeth and everything. It's really amazing. So I've had my eye on this book. It's been a bestseller in the science category on Amazon for a while, and I thought I'd pick it up. And I've seen a couple of books in this vein talking about the way our mouths develop with modern diets and things like that.
Yeah, I've seen that apparently our jaws are becoming narrower as a result of our diets because we're not chewing as much and not as much meat.
I've always toyed with covering like something like that on the show, but I've never seen it tied to breathing the way that James has done it with this book. And it's essentially a personal journey for him as well because he's all messed up.
Well, you said something to me that really grabbed my attention about it. You said, oh, I'm going to do this story about the fact that We breathe wrong now. I'm like, well, how can you breathe
you
wrong?
You do it wrong, Aaron.
Yeah, how can that happen? I mean, from the moment you're born, you're breathing. How do we breathe wrong? But allegedly we do.
Apparently 90% of us do.
90%?
Yeah. Well, do you snore?
No, I used to. I don't anymore. Actually, since I started exercising a lot more, I don't. But when I didn't, yeah, I did.
I always thought that snoring was just something normal. But he makes it very clear that if you snore, well, it's a cause of an underlying issue. Humans should not snore. And our ancestors, in fact, did not snore. And scientists are 100% sure of this based on the skulls that we've found of ancient people, you know, people that were going back beyond 300 years before the Industrial Revolution. The cavities in their nasal structures were completely different to ours today.
So what is that suggesting, that the Industrial Revolution was kind of responsible for this?
Well, I'll get into it. And I'm only covering half the book today, and a lot of the breathing kind of exotic breathing stuff I'll leave you to find out. I'm also tempted to get James on the show maybe in a couple of weeks' time to talk about that side of things.
Yeah.
But I want to hear what you've been digging up this week as well, because you mentioned Paul Stonehill, and whenever I hear the name Paul Stonehill, I know there's going to be some document that's been unearthed from the Soviet archives and only he has access to it.
Well,
it's all in Russian,
so
we can't check it.
I know that you're being facetious a little bit here, and I'm so pleased about that, because like, I really do think that a lot of the research that Paul does, whether or not it's genuine, I don't think he's making anything up. I don't think Paul is making any of this up. I think what he's doing is he's drawing on these old documents. I wonder, though, with some of the things that he's drawing upon, if there was also a Soviet disinformation campaign, like what we've heard with the US, you know, like what's happened to a number of people where they've been told certain things and they've been led down the garden path by the government on purpose as kind of like a counter-espionage kind of thing. So I get it that some of these things that might be occurring in the research that Paul's put together, but keeping that in mind, I'm going to go into some of the stories that he's pulled from the Phenomenon Institute. So the Phenomenon Institute is, from what I could find, and I had to use Google Translate to actually pull out some of these documents, but apparently the Phenomenon Institute was functioning as recently as 2006.
Oh, so it's a modern thing.
It's a relatively modern group. And what they do is that they collect just strange stories, strange encounters, their boots on the ground. They go and dig through archives and they pull out all these stories.
So it's like Russian MUFON.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, exactly. So I pulled a couple of stories from those of strange experiences that relate to distortions in time, time anomalies. And this is something that Paul has focused on in one of his recent videos. So I'm going to go into these some of these crazy stories about time anomalies, time slips, but more so, there's this one story that stands out that involves an odd time slip that seemed to be perpetuated by a UFO.
Oh.
The UFO was causing some type of, I mean, possibly it was being used essentially as a chrono weapon.
Chrono weapon.
As the headline of this show says. So I will go into that towards the end of the show, but let's get into this book about how we're all breathing wrong, Ben. Tell us how we're wrong.
So James Nestor, he's the author, and in the introduction he describes going through a really rough patch. He's basically stressed out at his job. His 130-year-old house was falling apart. He was spending all his time at home wheezing and working nonstop, eating three meals a day from the same bowl.
Ooh.
You know, hunched over newspapers on the couch, he says. And he's basically in a rut. He's physically in a rut, mentally in a rut. And after a few months of just being in this horrible position, his doctor gave him some advice and said, look, why don't you sign up to this breathing course and learn a technique called Sudarshan Kriya? And he says, fine. He goes along to this lady's house and it's like a volunteer thing she does. And he sits down with this odd group of people.
Is this a yogic exercise?
Well, he describes her basically playing a tape and it's like a guided meditation, but it's just focused on breathing.
Right.
And he's sitting down, he's listening to this Indian guy on the tape and describing this sing-song voice he has. And he kept breathing and breathing following this tape with this group of people. And he said, nothing happened. He said, no calmness swept over me, no tension released from my tight muscles, just nothing. He's really disappointed. 10 minutes passed, maybe 20 minutes passed, and he actually started getting annoyed. He's like, why am I spending my, you know, Friday night at this random house? It's cold, it's all dusty. What am I doing here? And he opened his eyes and looked around. And everyone else in the room had that same kind of bored look on their face.
Like, that's obviously not working.
They were over it too. And he actually thought about getting up and leaving, but the only thing that stopped him is he didn't want to be rude. And, you know, we always have that situation when we go to conferences. Where we know within like 10 minutes that the speaker is horrible. And I'm always like, I message you, I'm like, hey, you get up first. And then I'll wait 10 minutes and then I'll go, or vice versa.
And the problem is we're both big guys, so it's not easy to get out. It's pretty obvious when we stand up and you're towering over people.
And we're always in the front couple of rows. And you just see these two tall guys up and go, sorry, this is actually shit. And this is our job and we don't want to waste our time.
Yeah, I get it. I understand. I get it.
But what stops us is we always don't want to be rude, which is basically what stopped him. So he sat there in this session. The instructor was obviously volunteering her time. So he wanted to respect her charity. So he closed his eyes again and he wraps the blanket around him and he keeps breathing. And he said it only took a short while after this that something happened. He wasn't conscious of any transformation taking place. It wasn't like he had some weird kundalini experience. He never felt himself relax or the swarm of nagging thoughts leave his head. But he said, it was as if I'd been taken from one place and deposited somewhere else, and it happened in an instant. He said, the tape came to an end and I opened my eyes and there's something wet on his head. He's like, what? Is the ceiling leaking or something? What's going on? And he lifts his hand to wipe it off and he realizes his whole head is just soaked.
With what?
Well, he looks down at his torso and he's got massive sweat blotches all over his jeans and under his armpits. And the temperature of the room was 68 degrees. And it wasn't hot in there by any means. He was actually cold. And everyone else in there is wearing jackets and scarves and beanies. But he's somehow completely sweat through his clothes like he's run a marathon. So the instructor comes over and is like, what happened to you? She's asking if he's been sick or if he's had a fever, but he's like, no, I'm perfectly fine. She said something about the body's heat and how each inhaled breath provides us with new energy. Each exhale releases old, stale energy. And he tried to listen to her, but he was just preoccupied with how sweaty he was. He's like, how am I going to get home and how am I going to get changed and go to work? I'm covered in sweat. But the next day, he felt better. And there was this feeling of calm and quiet that he just hadn't experienced in a really long time. He slept really well. And little things in life that normally bother him, just he didn't care about them. The tension was gone from his shoulders and neck. And this actually lasted a few days before the feeling kind of faded out. And so he's asking these questions of, well, what happened to me? Had sitting cross-legged in a funky house and breathing for an hour triggered such a profound reaction? So he returned to the breathing class the next week and had the same experience, although he didn't sweat as much. And he said, I didn't mention it to any of my family members or friends, but I worked to understand what had happened. And I spent the next several years trying to figure it out. So figuring it out is really what resulted in this book. Eventually, he got out of his funk, he fixed up his house, and he explains in the intro that he got a lead on a story on freedivers.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, I think we spoke to Scott Carney years ago about freediving.
Yeah, we did.
He actually, the author James Nestor, he went to Greece and interviewed all these freediving experts. He wanted to explain how they think and how they did what they did, because they weren't really, you know, hardcore athletes. They were everyday people. And it wasn't like they were born with incredible abilities to hold their breath.
No, and yet they're doing incredible near superhuman feats.
Yeah, like they can go down for 12 minutes at a time. They can go down to depths that, you know, scientists thought weren't possible for the human body. And the whole thing with them is that it's just training. Like they've just trained their lungs to work harder. They've tapped on those pulmonary capabilities. And essentially, they all said, look, to freedive and do what we do, you have to master the art of breathing. And so he interviewed a bunch of them. They all had all these crazy stories. There was one instructor who could go down, you know, 8 minutes below 300 feet. She said, look, there's as many ways to breathe as there are foods to eat. And each way we breathe affects our body in different ways. Another diver told him that some methods of breathing nourish the brains while others will actually kill neurons. Some ways of breathing make us healthy while others will hasten our death. And they told him these crazy stories on how they had breathed in ways that expanded the size of their lungs by 30% or more, which is a huge
amount.
That's a huge number. They told him about an Indian doctor who had lost several pounds by simply changing the way he inhaled.
And stopped eating, obviously.
No, apparently, and there's a whole chapter on this, how carbon dioxide is one of the biggest regulators of your weight. And
really?
how much carbon dioxide is in your system. There's an argument that CO2 is actually more important than oxygen for the regulation of the body. It's really fascinating. Mm. He had this crazy story of a man who was injected with E. coli. And in a lab, he was doing this rhythmic breathing pattern to stimulate his immune system, and he destroyed the E. coli within minutes. I think that's Wim Hof, actually. I didn't get to that part in the book today, but I think he's talking about Wim Hof.
But it elicited an immune response, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He said, they told me about women who put their cancers into remission and monks who could melt circles in the snow, which is, of course, the Tummo meditation. He said it all sounded crazy. It sounded absolutely nuts. And he started reading through all the literature he could find on the subject. He thought, surely someone's, you know, debunked these crazy stories, or if there's something to it, I'll find some corroboration. And he found a ton of material. But the only problem was it was hundreds of years old, sometimes thousands of years old. Like he found 7 books dating back to 400 BCE from, you know, the Taoist texts focused entirely on breathing, how breathing could kill us or heal us. There was detailed instructions on how to regulate the breath, slow it down, hold it, swallow the breath. He talked about the stuff he found with Hindus and Buddhists. Basically, breathing for all these cultures was a powerful kind of medicine. But again, he started to look for some kind of verification in pulmonology, in Western science. And according to what he found, breathing wasn't important. Like, breathing's not important in Western medical science. Like, basically, the breath goes in your nose and that's it. You just breathe it out. That's the extent of what we have to worry about with breathing. You just got to do it. Your body does the rest. You just got to get the air in, breathe it out.
I guess it shows up more in things like psychotherapy, for example. If someone's suffering from anxiety, having a panic attack or that kind of thing, you're taught to regulate your breathing to bring yourself back in. You know, you're also taught In some circumstances, how to stop hyperventilation, respiratory acidosis. So breathing does play a role.
But pulmonary science, like looking at how the lungs function,
how
they collapse and what to do if there's a problem. There's no breathing techniques, he says, doesn't really play too much of a role in it. And so he kept digging. What he did discover was that there were scientists at Harvard and Stanford and other leading institutions across the world that actually were confirming some of these wild stories that the divers were telling him and some of these claims from hundreds and thousands of years ago.
Right.
But it wasn't in the pulmonology labs. The answers that were being found were in ancient burial sites, in dentists' offices, and in mental hospitals.
What do you mean, ancient burial sites? Yeah,
that's what I thought as soon as I read that. What are you talking about? He says, what they were discovering was that our capacity to breathe has gotten a lot worse since the industrial age. We've now discovered that 90% of us are breathing incorrectly, and it's causing a huge list of problems and chronic disease. And this new work that he was discovering was basically upending these long-held beliefs in Western science. Ultimately, he was showing that, and this is the point of the book, that no matter what we eat, how much we exercise, how resilient our genes are, how skinny and young or wise we are, none of that matters if you don't breathe correctly. You can be on the ultimate Spartan fitness routine, but if you don't breathe correctly, it doesn't mean anything. It's not going to get you to an optimum health state.
But then how do you know if you're breathing correctly? Like, what's the...
Most of us don't.
But what I'm saying is, what is breathing correctly? Like, if you're saying that we have to correct it, well, then where's the information on what we should do to correct it?
Well, I'll get into that. So in the
So he includes it.
Part of the book is really explaining the science behind it and some pointers on how you can introduce a different way of breathing into your life. And it's funny, when I cover some of these books that have a more scientific angle, I usually know that it's a good one when at the end of the day, after reading most of it, I've ordered about $100 worth of stuff from Amazon to try out all the body hacks. Yeah. And I did that today, but I'll get into that later. So in the first chapter, he meets up with this chief of rhinology research at Stanford. His name's Dr. Jayakar Nayak. And he's like a sinus surgeon, mm-hmm. expert sinus surgeon. And Dr. Nayak wants to put James through this really grueling experiment, which I can't believe he agreed to this. I would never do this. It sounds absolutely awful. Basically, he wants to make James a filthy mouth breather for 20 days straight. Filthy mouth, because that was always an insult. Back in the day, like, do you remember when you were growing up?
What are you talking about? I use it to refer to people at the post office all the time.
Yeah, exactly. It's the latest one for you. But we always used to call each other dirty mouth breathers when we were growing up. Like, it was an insult. And he even says in the book, he's spoken to friends who said when they went to school when they were younger, if you were caught breathing through your mouth, the teacher would basically tap you on the shoulder and say, stop that. You know, stop breathing through your mouth, breathe through your nose.
That would be unheard of today.
Well, that's a key part of how to breathe correctly. It kind of starts from breathing through your nose instead of your mouth. But basically, yeah, he meets up with this Stanford scientist and he wants him to plug his nose up with these big kind of silicone plugs for 20 days straight. Now, before he plugs him up, he does a huge barrage of tests, like puts him on a treadmill and a bicycle and measures his lung capacity.
Yeah, all the pulmonary stuff.
Does all these tests on his sinus bacteria and all this incredible stuff, gets all this data. And then basically plugs his nose up for 20 days. What a nightmare. Because it sucks when you're sick for, like, you've got a week of a head cold or something, you can't breathe through your nose.
Yeah, sure it does.
20 days of that? Ugh.
Yeah, no.
So he basically points out that 40% of today's population suffers from chronic nasal obstruction, and around half of us are habitual mouth breathers, with females and children suffering the most. The causes are many. Dry air, stress, inflammation, allergies is the big one that always gets me. Pollution, pharmaceuticals can cause issues. But most of the blame can be placed on the shrinking real estate in our skull. It's got to do with the shape of the modern head. It's really weird. So when your mouth doesn't grow wide enough, the roof of the mouth tends to rise up instead of going outwards. and it forms this V shape, like this high arched palate, he says. And the upward growth impedes the development of the nasal cavity. It basically shrinks your nasal passages. It disrupts all those structures up there, the delicate structures of the nose. And this reduced space leads to, obviously, obstruction. You don't get as much air going through. And he says overall humans are the most plugged up species on the planet. Like other mammals do not have this problem across the entire animal kingdom. It's just humans that are like...
But is that a result of our advances in technology, that it's causing evolutionary changes?
That's a part of it, and I'll get to that. But it's interesting because James is a really bad example of this. He's a really... He's a bad case of just this obstructed nasal cavity. He has that V-shaped palate. He also has severe obstruction of his left nostril. He's got a severely deviated septum. His sinuses are riddled with deformities. His airways are such a mess that this Stanford scientist is amazed that he didn't have more like respiration problems and infections.
What a bad hand to be dealt.
And yeah, he was reasonably certain that he would have some kind of serious breathing problems in the future as he got older. And over the next 10 days of forced mouth breathing, he was going to be putting himself through a kind of mucus ball. Like he was going to amplify what a lot of people kind of suffer through as they get older with these breathing problems.
Yeah.
And because obviously when the nasal cavity gets congested, you get less airflow, which means more bacteria, tons more bacteria. The bacteria replicates, you get infections.
More inflammation.
More congestion. It just sets off like a chain reaction of problems.
Yep.
And by the time it gets to that stage, you've got no choice but to breathe through your mouth because you're so blocked up. So they do all these tests on him and he kind of takes a side note here and he says a few months earlier, he was in Philadelphia and he was meeting with Dr. Mariana Evans. She's an orthodontist. And she's also a serious dental researcher. She'd spent several years looking into the mouths of human skulls, modern human skulls with her patients, but also ancient human skulls. So when he meets her, they go to the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, and there's hundreds of skull specimens down there. And each of them is engraved with letters and numbers and the race of the skull. So you've got Bedouins, Copts, and it says Arab of Egypt, for example, or Negro born in Africa. There's Brazilian prostitutes. There's Arab slaves. There's Persian prisoners. They're just from everywhere, these skulls. Some of them are 200 years old. Some of them are thousands of years old. And the collection came from is it phrenology when they used to measure people's skulls?
Oh, I don't know the exact word, but that sounds about right.
To compare the races. It was one of these guys in the 1800s who was, you know, trying to prove that white people had bigger skulls or something, or bigger brains.
Yeah, and it was also the idea that you could measure if someone was going to be a criminal or not by the ratios of their skull.
That's basically what this guy was doing. Yeah. And his research...
completely debunked.
His research didn't go anywhere, but he just had a massive collection of skulls, which is now in this... Museum of Archaeology, and she had access to it.
So a wealth of information that she could use.
Well, she starts going to one of these skulls and she grabs this skull marked Parsi, which basically means Persian. She grabs it from the cabinet and she kind of wipes the dust off it. And she says, look, she starts tracing the sinus cavity. And she says, look at these holes. She says, these holes are twice as large as ours today. And she's pointing at the nasal apertures, the two holes that are at the back of the throat that connect to the nasal passages. And she just says, look at them. She turns the skull over and she says, they're so wide, they're so pronounced. And this is what they've discovered, her and her colleague, Dr. Kevin Boyd, a pediatric dentist. They've spent the last 4 years x-raying hundreds of skulls from this collection and they compare them to the measurements from their patients. And they're just blown away by the symmetry of each specimen, how well proportioned the mouth is relative to the nose, how good the palate is, and how the ancient people who owned these skulls, how incredibly well they would have breathed. They certainly wouldn't have been mouth breathers. They would never have snored. The idea that our ancestors snored is a joke. Snoring is a modern problem. Our ancestors never did it.
So what went wrong?
Well, he starts to go into the details. So every single one of these ancient skulls, they have an enormous forward-facing jaws. So their jawline was much bigger than ours.
Much more wider.
Wider and more forward.
Yeah.
They have these expansive sinus cavities, really broad mouths. And the other thing that's kind of bizarre, and we probably know this from other research, and it's always tied to diet, they argue that they never flossed and they never brushed, although, you know, they probably did do dental stuff. But they certainly didn't have the dentistry technology we have today. But every single skull has perfect straight teeth. There isn't an exception. It doesn't matter where in the world the skull comes from, whether it's from Africa or Europe or Persia. Perfect teeth. And these, the forward facial growth, the larger mouths, they create wider airways. These people never snored. They never had apnea. They never had sinus problems. They would have taken in much more oxygen, more air. And they just breathed easy. Ancient people breathed easy. He said nearly all ancient humans shared this forward structure from everywhere around the world. And of course, then the researchers, they compared them to modern skulls. And every modern skull is basically the opposite growth pattern. So everything's reversed. Chins are recessed behind the foreheads. Jaws are slumped back. The sinuses are all shrunken. All the modern skulls have some form of crooked teeth. And when we're talking about modern skulls, we're talking about you and me and everyone listening to this show. We all, unless you're some kind of Uber person who's just eaten carrots your whole life, we all have this problem.
Yeah.
And again, it's this thing. It's like only humans out of all the mammals have this issue. And this is where, you know, you mentioned evolution a little bit earlier. This is the opposite of survival of the fittest. It's like there's a term for it. It's called disevolution. It's kind of explaining why our backs ache, our feet hurt, our bones are growing more brittle. We're actually adopting and passing down traits that are detrimental to our health. We're not getting better, we're getting worse. So in the first half of the book, Nesta basically alternates between interviews with these really fascinating researchers who are on the cusp of this stuff. Like they're finding this new evidence, and that's why it says some of the information is coming from ancient burial grounds.
Oh, okay.
Because they're looking at these ancient skulls. And he goes back and forth between that and this crazy experiment of having his nose plugged for 20 days straight. So after the second night, his snoring has increased by 1,300%. his colleague who does the experiment with him, his numbers are even worse. He went from zero snoring hours a night to 4 hours a night. He had a bunch of sleep apnea. And this is all within the first 24 hours of plugging his nose. And it was an absolute challenge. Like every 3.3 seconds when he breathes in, there's this blast of unfiltered, unmoistened, unheated air entering his mouth that dries out his tongue, irritates his throat, pisses off his lungs. And he's only 2 days into the experiment. Halfway through the experiment, his blood pressure is 13 points from where it was before they did the experiment. He's now into stage one of hypertension. If they leave that unchecked, he's going to have chronically raised blood pressure. It'll lead to heart attack, stroke, other serious problems. His heart rate variability, which measures his nervous system balance, has now plummeted. His body's in a state of stress. His pulse has increased. His body temperature has decreased. His mental clarity's hit rock bottom. His test subject colleague had the same kind of data. But the worst part about it was they just felt like shit.
Like, yeah, you would.
They just felt absolutely awful, and each day was getting worse. And he said, each night for the past week and a half, I felt as if I was getting softly choked to death in my sleep, and my throat was closing in on itself because basically it is, and because I am. He said, forced mouth breathing was very likely changing the shape of my airways. The changes weren't happening in a matter of months, but days. It was getting worse with every breath I took. My snoring, he says, has increased 4,820% from 10 days ago. For the first time that I'm aware of, I'm beginning to suffer from obstructive sleep apnea. And this is where we kind of go into some of the ancient wisdom side of this, because he has a bunch of quotes. One of them's from a Dutch physician from the 1500s who said, "More wholesome to sleep with the mouth shut, for they that sleep with their jaws extended, by reason of their breath and the air tossed to and fro, have their tongues and palates dry and desire to be moistened by drinking in the night. And he says this is another thing that happens if you breathe with your mouth open. He kept on having to get up and get a drink of water. He's waking up constantly, like
because
parched
drying out.
And dry. And he said you'd think the moisture loss would decrease the need to urinate, but it's the opposite. You need to go to the toilet all the time because you're breathing with your mouth open. Because there's something that kicks into gear when you breathe through your nose that regulates your need to pee during the night.
Oh, it's like an autonomous kind of thing.
Yeah, there's some kind of thing that gets turned on. So basically, that's why I asked you at the start of the show if you snore. And
well, not since I exercise.
Yeah.
When I exercise, no snoring at all.
Yeah. And I don't realize I do, but my wife always says that I snore. So there's obviously some underlying problem.
Do you know the other thing where I stopped snoring is I quit alcohol.
Oh, yeah.
So not drinking. When I used to drink alcohol, I would snore. Not drinking it, don't snore.
Maybe I've got to get off caffeine. That usually helps. Well, he says that basically speaks to this expert, Dr. Christian Guliminal, a sleep researcher at Stanford, who says that contrary to what most people think, no amount of snoring is normal. If you're snoring, there's a problem. And even a tiny bit of snoring in children, not even sleep apnea, just a bit of heavy breathing and light snoring in children can lead to mood disorders, blood pressure, derangements, learning disabilities.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? And, you know, it's one of those things where I just thought, oh, yeah, snoring, like everyone kind of snores when they sleep. It's kind of normal.
Well, if you even watch like kids' cartoons or whatever and they're imitating someone sleeping, they snore. It's like the sound effect they make. It's just expected.
It's not. It's this modern disease that 90% of us have, which is why we consider it normal. But it's not a normal human healthy condition. Mouth breathing also makes you dumb.
That's why they're called mouth breathers.
This is why the insult works. A recent Japanese study showed that rats who had their nostrils obstructed and were forced to breathe through their mouths developed fewer brain cells and took twice as long to make their way through a maze than nasal breathing control mice. So if you're feeling like a bit of a dummy because you've been breathing through your mouth all night because you're all congested, it's probably because you're a bit of a dummy because you've been breathing through your mouth all
so
night.
So it's true.
It's true. And the ancient Chinese were onto it as well. He says there's this quote from one of those Taoist manuscripts saying the breath inhaled through the mouth is called Nichi, adverse breath, which is extremely harmful. The text says, be careful not to have the breath inhaled through the mouth. And on that topic of ancient wisdom, he has some pretty incredible information on the Shiva Swarodaya. The Shiva Swarodaya is this tantric text. It's about 1,300 years old. And essentially it describes how one nostril will open to let the breath in as the other closes throughout the day. So some days the right nostril yawns awake to greet the sun, according to this text. And other days the left awakens to the fullness of the moon. And these rhythms are the same throughout every month. And it's the same for everyone on planet Earth. Like every human being has this nasal rhythm. And apparently it's a method, according to this 1,300-year-old text, that our bodies use to stay balanced. They use it to stay grounded and connected to the cosmos. Kind of this really, you know, airy-fairy Eastern kind
fluffy,
of thing.
Yeah.
But in 2004, there was this Indian surgeon. His name was Ananda Bhavanani. And he wanted to scientifically test this ancient tantric text on a group of subjects and people from all over the world. So over the course of a month, he found that when the influence of the sun and the moon and the earth was at its strongest during a full or a new moon, the students matched that Shiva Swarodaya pattern. The text was correct. And he says, look, more research needs to be done on this, but recent science has confirmed that our nostrils pulse to their own rhythm. It actually happens. Your nostrils open and close at different times of the day, like a flower petal, like a flower opening.
What, in response to external stimulus or this?
It's like the circadian rhythm. It's like they're on this natural cycle. So the phenomenon's called nasal cycles. It was actually first described in 1895 by a German physician. His name was Richard Kaiser. And he noticed it with his patients. He went around, I don't know, just watching them breathe. He noticed their nostrils Like one of them would be closed and congested and the other would mysteriously open, like just psh, like a flower opening up. Then after about...
What do you mean? How is he seeing the nostrils? Because when you're congested, the nostril doesn't actually close. Is he talking internally with the tissue swelling? Is that what...
No, like you actually see the nostril move. I know you're looking at me like I'm crazy. No, this is documented. This has been observed. Your nostril opens like a flower. And he noticed after 30 minutes, sometimes up to a couple of hours, the nostrils would cycle. So the other one would go psh, and the other one would close. Like a little valve opening up. And this is where we get into the nose boner. And because it was a German scientist.
Of course it's German.
He would have called it the Nasensteif.
Lovely.
Which is... Nose stiff.
Nose erection.
Nose erection. So the interior of our nose, it's basically blanketed in erectile tissue.
Is that a banana on your nose? You're just happy to see me.
Yeah, basically that's what happens. Like it's, yeah, pretty crappy joke, but that happens. That's exactly what happens. So it's the same flesh that covers the penis, the clitoris, and the nipples. Noses get erections.
Hang on. So are you, are they suggesting, so when you get sexually aroused, that you're... nostrils flare out? Is that what they're saying?
Within seconds, they too can engorge with blood and become large and stiff. This happens because the nose is more intimately connected to the genitals than any other organ. When one gets aroused, the other responds. So I'm going to be keeping an eye on your nostrils, young man. If I see any flare-ups...
Like, I was about to say I'm dead below the waist anyway, but now, like, obviously it's my nose.
I don't know what's going on your computer screen because I can't see it. But if I see any flare-ups, I'm like, what is he looking at over there?
Wow.
So essentially, sexual stimulation, as it weakens, the same thing happens in your nose. The erectile tissue in your nose becomes flaccid.
Oh, well,
and your nose is like...
So obviously then, do you have like nose erectile problems as you get older? Because obviously...
I don't know.
Well, the thing is, right, so that tissue, there's very, very fine capillaries all the way through it. So with particularly in the penis, there's, all this very fine tissue with all these capillaries. And as you go through life, if you don't exercise or if you have high blood pressure, it destroys those capillaries. So it results in erectile dysfunction. So I'm wondering if it's causing exactly the same thing for someone's... nasal passages.
For the breathing as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. So what's disappointing is that German scientist who first observed this in what was the late 1800s, basically he documented everything. He tried to communicate what he had observed. And for decades, no one really bothered to figure out why it was doing that, like why our nostrils do that, how it happened. Researchers, decades later, eventually confirmed that nasal erectile tissue mirrors states of health. So it becomes inflamed during sickness. And if there's other states of imbalance, your nose, that tissue behaves in a particular way. If the nose can become infected, the nasal cycle becomes more pronounced. So they start switching. The left nostril and the right nostril start doing that cycle a lot quicker. They kind of work like an HVAC system, he says. Like
bringing one out.
Yeah, they control temperature and blood pressure, and they feed the brain chemicals. They alter our moods, emotions, and sleep states. So when I was reading this, that's when I realized that kooky kind of yoga breathing that I did years ago, where we were holding one nostril closed, like breathing in through the right, and then
breathing out
through the left nostril. This actually does real measurable things to your biology. And this is where he kind of lays out what it does. So the right nostril is your gas pedal. So when you're inhaling primarily through your right nostril, through this channel, this is getting your body hotter. It's boosting your cortisol levels, blood pressure, your heart rate increases. This happens because it's connected to the sympathetic nervous system. It's connected to your fight or flight mechanism. On the other hand, if you're breathing in through the left nostril, that has the opposite effect. So the left nostril is kind of a brake system to the right nostril's accelerator. The left nostril is more deeply connected to the parasympathetic nervous system. So that, of course, lowers blood pressure, cools the body, reduces anxiety. So one of the exercises...
Oh, so by doing that exercise, I see it calm.
So one of the exercises to kind of get yourself a bit energized for the day was to breathe in through the right nostril and out through the left. But then you could reverse it if you want to calm down. You do that for 10 minutes. And there's been some incredible research on this. Like in 2015 at the University of California, they were recording breathing patterns of a schizophrenic patient. and they recorded the breathing patterns over 3 years. And they found that she breathed in a lot more through her left nostril. She had this weird left nostril dominance. And they hypothesized that this was overstimulating the creative part of her brain, like the right side of her brain.
Oh, so hence voices and hallucinations.
Yeah, it was kind of contributing to her imagination running amok and, you know, that the symptoms from schizophrenia. Yep. So over several sessions, what they did was they taught her to reverse her breathing. They taught her to use the logic nostril, the right nostril, and mainly breathe through that nostril. And she followed their instructions and she experienced fewer hallucinations. She started to improve in her condition. And I just thought, that's amazing. That's just changing the way you're breathing. And it's impacting this huge psychological, you know, biological issue in your mind. So this is where we get back to the ancient wisdom part of this story. And he covers the 1500 BCE, there's this Ebers Papyrus, one of the oldest medical texts ever discovered. And that offered a description of how nostrils would feed the air to the heart and lungs, not the mouth. 1,000 years later, he has a quote from Genesis talking about how the Lord God formed man off the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. He's got examples from the Chinese Taoist text from the 8th century saying the nose is the heavenly door and breath must be taken in through it and never to do otherwise because danger and illness will set in. Again, if you're mouth breathing, not only are you a dummy, you're also going to get sick. And then we get to what I thought was this fantastic story. It's this artist and researcher named George Catlin. And he did most of his work in the 1800s. It was in 1830 that he was a lawyer, but he just found it so tedious that he left to become a portrait painter in Philadelphia. He wanted to paint high society. He wanted a more creative job. But eventually his health started failing. He started to have breathing issues and he thought, I need to get into nature and capture real depictions of humanity. I'm going to paint, you know, the Native Americans. And that's what he does. He actually goes out into thousands of miles across the Great Plains, you know. He goes to Missouri. He lives with the Lakota Sioux. He meets with the Pawnee, the Omaha, the Blackfeet clan. He goes to and lives with all these Indian tribes, right? And he realized that no one had really, well, this one tribe, the Mandan, they're kind of interesting. A lot of them had luminous blue eyes and snow white hair, and they lived in bubble shaped houses, this Mandan tribe. And he realized no one really knew anything about them because no one had spent any time with them. Like European researchers hadn't really sat down and asked them any questions. So he ended up living with all these tribes and researching them and painting them and documenting all this information. It was just incredible work. And he ended up painting 600 portraits and taking hundreds of pages of notes and learning how they live and what they believe and all that sort of stuff. But obviously the tribes were different region by region, right? They all had different customs, different diets and traditions. You know, some ate only buffalo and maize, and some, you know, had plants and flowers and varying hair colors, varying skin tone, like all that stuff. They're different people. But he noticed that all the 50 tribes he spent time with, they all had the same kind of superhuman physical characteristics compared to the modern Europeans that he knew back home. He said in some groups, such as the Crow and the Osage, Catlin wrote, there were few men at their full growth who were less than 6 feet in stature. Very many of them were 6.5 feet tall and others were 7 feet tall. They all seemed to share a Herculean make of broad shoulders and barrel chests, and the women were kind of tall and striking as well. He just thought, it's amazing. How are these people so fit? The other thing he noticed was that the tribal people all had perfect teeth. Like, they're all perfectly straight. They'd never seen a dentist or a doctor. And no one seemed to get sick. They didn't have deformities. They didn't have chronic health problems. It was kind of rare if they did, or basically non-existent. And when he basically asked the tribes, why are you guys so healthy? You know, what's your secret? And the answer he got was the great secret of life. And the secret of life was breathing. So the Native Americans explained to Catlin that breath inhaled through the mouth sapped the body of strength, it deformed the face and caused stress and disease. On the other hand, breath inhaled through the nose kept the body strong, made the face beautiful, and prevented the disease.
Surely it can't be that simple, because to change the physiological features of someone, including, you know, malocclusion in their teeth and all that kind of thing, how would breathing change that? Are we talking about, like, this must be 20, 30 years that this is causing this effect to take place, which is also influencing what epigenetics?
So one thing that came to mind with what he was doing and the ledger reports from the natives was, okay, well, is this just something that they're told, and how do you put it into practice? Because I know that I breathe a fair bit with my mouth when I sleep. And there are ways to train yourself.
You look like a bit of a mouth breather, does that make sense?
You're not, that's why I'm a Dumbo, because I breathe through my mouth. But there's ways you can train yourself out of it. But I thought, how could all these cultures, who are obviously very different, separated by vast distances, all have this drilled into them that you have to breathe through your nose and it's become automatic for them? Well, the answer was that it started at birth. So when mothers would, and this was in all the tribes that he followed, it wasn't just one or two, it was all of them. When the mothers had finished breastfeeding their baby, they would close the baby's lips with their fingers after breastfeeding to make sure the baby would breathe through the nose and not the mouth. It starts very early and it's drilled into them at every point. They would stand over their sleeping infants, you know, their toddlers, and gently pinch their mouths closed if they found them breathing through their mouth. Some tribes strapped infants to a straight board and placed a pillow beneath their heads and created a posture that made it very difficult for them to breathe through their mouths. This is how serious they approached this mouth breathing issue. They're like, we're not going to have any mouth breathers in our tribe. We're going to do everything we can to stop it.
I understand that. I appreciate that.
Even during winter, infants would be wrapped in light clothing and then held at arm's length on warmer days so they'd be less prone to get too hot and start panting and breathe through their mouths.
Oh, it's that serious.
So everything they did was training children to breathe through their noses all day, every day, no matter what. And essentially, this is a habit that built up and it was with them for the rest of their lives. And this was shared universally through these tribes for God knows how long.
And has that stopped? Is that a practice which is no longer encouraged?
Well, you know, most of the tribes would live, you know, modern lifestyles these days. So I imagine it all would have changed. But back in Catlin's day, you know, 20 years later, he wasn't finished. Like he was done with North America. So he goes off again. He's 56 years old. He starts living with indigenous tribes in South America. He goes to the Andes, he goes to Argentina, he goes to Brazil. Every tribe he visits over the next several years, dozens of them, have the same breathing habits. They also shared the same vigorous health. They all have perfect teeth and they all have that forward-growing facial structure. Now, he wrote about this in this book called The Breath of Life. He published it in 1862 and it was devoted solely to breathing and the hazards of mouth breathing. Now, Catlin became a practitioner as well, because remember when he set out to do all this, he had health issues. He felt like, he had this respiratory problem when he was young, but by the time he was in his 30s, it was so severe, he would start spitting up blood. And his friends and doctors basically said, like, you've got lung disease, you don't have long to live. But he persevered with this training he learnt from the natives, and he forced himself to stop breathing through his mouth. And soon the aches and pain stopped, the bleeding stopped. And by his mid-30s, he said he felt healthier than he ever had in his entire life. And he died when he was 76. He credited his longevity to that great secret of life, to always breathe through your nose. So there's tons of proven benefits on this that have been, you know, documented by modern science in terms of breathing through your nose. I won't go into all of them, but, you know, some of them is things like you're boosting nitric oxide when you're breathing through your nose, which is playing an essential role in increasing circulation. It's delivering oxygen into your cells.
And isn't nitric also involved in erections as well?
Yeah, you're right. Sexual function, immune function, weight, circulation, all of it's influenced by the amount of nitric oxide in your body. And nasal breathing alone boosts nitric oxide in your system. mouth taping is one of the ways to naturally do this. So this is one of the Amazon orders I did, was I ordered this sleep tape. And it's not a CD that you put in and listen to get you to sleep. It's tape that you put on your mouth to train yourself to breathe through your nose while you're sleeping. It sounds crazy, right? But it's kind of a dorky thing to do, just button your mouth up when you go to sleep. But apparently, after doing this...
Oh, wow, there's actually a lot of it.
Yeah, it takes about 4 to 6 weeks. And if you persevere, apparently it's very difficult to start with, but if you persevere, it's like anything when your muscles are atrophied. When you start forcing yourself at night to breathe through your nose only, you're starting to stimulate all these atrophied muscles up there in the nasal cavities, all these, passages. And after 4 to 6 weeks, it's natural. You don't need to use the tape anymore. You're just naturally breathing through your nose every night.
Did you order the Nihongo Jizzy Sleep Strips?
The Jizzy Sleep Strips, no.
What's it called?
Is that the Japanese version?
It's like a Japanese version. Okay. It looks a little bit filthy, but I get it. Like you're putting
it's shaped like a woman's legs.
No, these ones are penises. But basically, you're right. You're using like a Band-Aid and you're sticking your top lip to your lower lip.
Yeah. You're basically just taping your mouth shut.
That's not going to be very comfortable all night.
Well, apparently the first three nights aren't that great. But eventually, because you got to force yourself to start breathing through your nose.
Well, the woman on the package is smiling, so it can't be that bad, surely.
Well, he says in the three nights since he started first using the tape, he went from snoring 4 hours to only 10 minutes at night. And he has this little app that records how long you snore at night. He'd been warned that the sleep tape wouldn't really do anything for his apnea, but he found that his apnea disappeared as well.
I actually want to try these now.
Yeah, so I've ordered it. It'll take a week to come, but I'm going to try it and start seeing if I can get my snoring to stop as well.
Well, what's interesting about this, and maybe I've missed you saying it, Ben, but it's saying also in addition to those benefits you were describing, it's designed or it's supposed to encourage a more consistent deep sleep, which is something that we don't get in modern times. We seem to drop into more REM than we do actual deep sleep.
Well, he also stopped waking up and needing to pee because
right, when you're affecting diuretic hormone or something.
Yeah, remember I said earlier it affects how you pee. It stimulates your pituitary gland when you're breathing through your nose.
Right. Okay.
And it releases vasopressin, which is basically telling you, no, you don't need to pee. You're fine. Keep sleeping. And he was sleeping. It was incredible. He was sleeping so soundly.
Now, you can also get a chin band. It's like a strap that you strap your chin up.
Yeah, what was the other thing I ordered? I ordered a couple of things. Oh, the other thing I ordered, I'll get to in a moment. Just quickly, because all these chapters are full of this incredible stuff, and there's a ton of stuff I've left out, the very technical stuff on how breathing through your nose affects, you know, different chemicals in the brain. I've skipped over a lot of that stuff, but if you want to dive into the deep science, it's all in the book. But I did want to mention this connection between breathing and prayer, which I found really weird. So when Buddhist monks... they chant their mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, you know, that old one.
Yeah.
Each phrase lasts 6 seconds, and then there's a 6 second pause before you, or 6 second inhale before you repeat the chant. The traditional chant of Om, from Jainism and other traditions, that takes 6 seconds to sing the Om, and then there's a pause, and then there's a 6 second inhale. There's this weird kind of 6 second thing that pops up a lot. The Satanama chant from Kundalini Yoga, that's 6 seconds, and there's a 6 second inhale. There's the ancient Hindu hand and tongue poses called the mudras, and one of the mudras, the kachari, which boosts your physical and spiritual health, the breath takes 6 seconds, and the exhale takes 6 seconds. Doesn't matter where you go, Japanese, African, Hawaiian, Native American, Buddhist, Taoist, Christian. All of these cultures and religions somehow have this 6 second prayer technique and this breathing pattern.
So there's something about 6 seconds.
It's the same everywhere because it has this calming effect. So in 2001, researchers at the University of Pavia in Italy, they gathered 24 subjects and they put sensors all over them and they wanted to measure, you know, blood flow and heart rate and nervous system feedback and all that. And they got them to recite a Buddhist mantra, as well as the Latin version of the rosary, you know, the Catholic Ave Maria prayer. And they were stunned to find that the average number of breaths for each cycle was basically identical, 5.5 breaths per minute. So it doesn't matter if you're using the Catholic rosary or some kind of Buddhist mantra, it's 5.5 seconds. It's about 6 seconds. But what was even more stunning was that the breathing, what it did to the subjects is blood flow to the brain increased, the systems in the body entered a state of coherence, the heart, the circulation, the nervous system were all at peak efficiency. But the moment the subjects returned to spontaneous breathing or talking, the hearts would become erratic, the integration would fall apart. And a decade after these Pavia tests, two renowned professors and doctors in New York, Patria Gerberg and Richard Brown, they used the same breathing pattern on patients with anxiety, depression, and they basically fixed a lot of their chronic breathing problems. They breathed out longer, their lung capacity increased, and they found when they were doing their research, this is totally independent, that to get the optimum breathing technique for their patients, they figured out, oh, they've got to breathe in for about 5.5 seconds and breathe out for about 5.5 seconds. So it's this really weird...
strange how it aligns to something which is an ancient practice.
Yeah, it's like all these ancient practices from these ancient cultures figured it out thousands of years ago.
Well, you know what it is, and maybe this is just a product of how, you know, we're becoming a very technological society, but we seem to be obsessed with how things work. And that's fine. I mean, this is what humanity does. I mean, we're looking, we want to understand, we want to, you know, piece together how everything works. And I understand that. But there's a lot of things in science that we don't understand how it works, but it just works and we just accept it.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that in, you know, olden days or in olden times. You can tell that there were, you know, procedures and practices that people engaged in. They didn't know what it did or how it worked, but they knew it did work.
I would push back on that and say they did know how it worked, because in the Chinese text, they're saying, if you breathe in through your mouth, it's going to give you disease. They understood it very specifically.
But maybe they wouldn't understand exactly the mechanism of how that would work, but they were able to find a causal link.
Well, their mechanisms were different.
Yeah.
They didn't use the mechanisms that Western science used.
Yes, exactly.
They would speak in terms of, you know, energy centers and things like that, but it's the same thing. So this is where we got to my favorite chapter, which will answer some of the questions, you know, you've been peppering me with, was how is the face changing, for example? How is all this working? So he starts going back through history. There's a bit of a history lesson to understand this. 12,000 years ago, humans in Southwest Asia and the Fertile Crescent in the Eastern Mediterranean, they stopped essentially being hunter-gatherers and they started to grow their food. And in these primitive communities, humans started to suffer from the first instances of crooked teeth and deformed mouths. Mm. While one farming culture was plagued by facial and mouth deformities, though, another 100 miles away didn't really suffer. So it was kind of random. The crooked teeth and breathing problems were random.
And sporadic.
Then about 300 years ago, all these problems went viral. Suddenly, most of the world's population started to have these problems. The mouths started to shrink. Faces grew flatter. Sinuses started to shrink and get plugged up. It only took a few generations for things to get really bad. The changes triggered by the rapid industrialization of farmed foods were really damaging. He says within a few generations of eating this stuff, modern humans became the worst breathers in Homo history, the worst breathers in the animal kingdom. And he started to think, why hadn't I been told this stuff in school? And why didn't so many of the sleep doctors or dentists or pulmonologists I had interviewed know this story? And he said, because this research I discovered wasn't happening in the halls of medicine, it was happening in ancient burial sites. The anthropologists working at these sites told me that if I wanted to really understand how such a sudden and dramatic change could happen to us and why, I needed to leave the labs and get out into the field. I needed to get my hands on some skulls. So there's a bit of a side story, which I won't go into. He basically goes to Paris and goes to the catacombs.
Oh, wow.
And he starts looking at all the skulls there. And
how old are they?
Well, they're modern.
Okay.
They're all, you know, within 300 years and they all had the same problems.
Yep.
They've all got the same problems we do. But back to the history lesson, he says it was around the year 1500, the farming that had begun in Southwest Asia and the Fertile Crescent took over the world. The entire world started to do this industrial style farming.
Yeah.
And this was the first time in history humans could spend their entire lives eating nothing but processed food. So nothing fresh, nothing raw, everything was kind of, you know, processed. Advances in milling started to remove the germ and bran from rice, so we only had the starchy white stuff left over. Roller mills and later steam mills ripped the germ and bran from wheat, leaving only a soft white flour. Meats, fruits, and vegetables were canned and bottled. All these methods extended the shelf life of foods and made them more accessible to the public. Great. They also made the foods mushy and soft, though. Sugar, which was once a prized commodity, became increasingly common and cheap. And the newly highly processed diet lacked fiber, the full spectrum of minerals, vitamins, amino acids, and other nutrients. And as a result, urban populations started to grow sicker and smaller. So the average Briton, I think it was in the before the 1730s, they were about 5'7". And within a century, the average Brit was 5'5". They actually lost 2 inches because of these changes in industrial food. And the human face started to deteriorate. Mouths started to shrink. Facial bones grew stunted. Dental disease became rampant. And the incidence of crooked teeth and jaws increased tenfold in the industrial age. Our mouths got so bad, so overcrowded, that it became common to have teeth removed altogether. And of course, because of this, breathing problems skyrocketed. Everyone starts snoring, having problems getting all the air in, and that cascades into other chronic issues. So what was all this about? What was it about this industrialized food that caused all this? So researchers suspected that the food was a problem. This isn't, you know, some blind spot. They knew that the changing diets were part of this, but they tried to figure out why. One of the leading guys in the 1930s was Weston Price. He was the founder of the National Dental Association Research Institute. He actually thought it was probably vitamins. So he set out to do all this research. He traveled to a dozen countries, compiled more than 15,000 print photographs, 4,000 slides of dental records, saliva records. Like, he just went all out, right? And no matter where he went, this is what he found. Societies that replaced their traditional diet with modern processed food obviously had more cavities, but then they had the severely crooked teeth, obstructed airways, and just shitty health, basically. Yep. The modern diets were all the same no matter where you went. White flour, white rice, sweetened juices, jams, canned vegetables, processed meats. But the traditional diets were all different. So some cultures ate nothing but meat. Some were mostly vegetarian. Some mostly ate cheese. You know, some had no dairy at all. But no matter where you went with the traditional diets, the teeth were always perfect. The mouths were exceptionally wide. Their nasal apertures were, you know, nice and big and broad. They didn't have any cavities. They didn't have dental disease. Their respiratory diseases and asthma were basically non-existent. And at the end of this, this guy, Price, became convinced it must be, it's not vitamin D. They thought it might be vitamin D. It's not vitamin C. It must be all vitamins. And to an extent, he was correct. Like, there was a vitamin deficiency in those processed foods. But it was only half of the story. He was half right. Because yes, vitamin deficiencies, they'll explain why lots of people were getting sick, why they might be getting cavities because of sugar, and why they're getting thinner and weaker and shorter. But it couldn't explain the sudden and extreme shrinking of the mouth, the blocking of the airways that was sweeping through society. Even if our ancestors consumed a full spectrum of vitamins and minerals every day, their mouths would still grow too small, their teeth would come in crooked, and their airways would become obstructed. So what was the problem? What is it about modern diets that leave us with all these problems, that change the shape of our face, that give us this breathing problems, that make us snore and create all these other issues? The problem is really simple. It's chewing.
So we're not chewing enough because the food's already processed?
It's simply chewing. The stress of chewing suddenly started to vanish from our diets. 95% of that modern processed diet was soft. And he points out, even if you think about healthy foods today, what's a healthy food? Smoothies, nut butters, oatmeal, avocados, whole wheat bread, vegetable soups. It's all soft, right? He says our ancient ancestors chewed for hours a day, every day. And because they chewed so much, Their mouths, teeth, throats, and faces grew to be wide and strong and pronounced. Food in industrialized societies was so processed that it hardly required any chewing at all. This is why so many of those skulls he had seen in Paris, like those modern skulls in the catacombs, they all had narrow faces, they all had crooked teeth. This is why so many of us snore today. It's why our noses get snuffed up, why our airways are clogged, why 50% of you listening now are filthy mouth breathers. This is why we need sprays, pills, surgical tape. Drilling, tape over our mouths. It's all got to do with chewing. So what can we do about it? Well, he says the best medicine is preventative, obviously. There's got to be a way to reverse the entropy of the airways, open them up. There's got to be a way we can avoid sleep apnea and all this anxiety, these chronic respiratory problems.
Surely it's too late for us. I mean, this might be, you're talking about a generational thing.
Well, it's funny. He goes back through the history of orthodontic techniques. And you know, today when you've got an issue, like you need to rebalance where your teeth are going, sometimes because it's getting crowded, they'll take a tooth out.
Yeah.
Like they'll take a couple of teeth out so that the mouth there's basically falls into place. It's funny because my wife did this. I can't wait to tell her about this book because she's just gone through 9 months of orthodontics and she's about to get her braces removed.
Don't scare the poor girl.
It's all backwards. But basically before the 1940s, all the orthodontic work was trying to make the mouth bigger. You would put in these things. I can't remember what they were called, but they were basically...
Oh, like spacer kind of things to bring the jaw out.
Yeah, there was this... I wrote it down. There's a specific name for it. But essentially, it just... It's kind of like a retainer, but it expands your mouth.
But it's like a big brace thing that you wear on your face.
Not necessarily. No? Sometimes they went inside your mouth. Yeah, some of them you'd strap over your jaw.
Because that's the joke about headgear, right? And headgear doesn't really exist in modern orthodontics anymore.
Yeah. Essentially, they're trying to... make the mouth larger. And when you make the mouth larger and make all this bone kind of expand out, the teeth just naturally go straight because there's all this room.
Yeah.
They just fall into position. But the process took expertise, it took maintenance, and the skill of the dentist was really important. But by the 1940s, they basically figured out, oh, we can just take teeth out and that creates room. And then the teeth will basically fall into place. But what this was doing, what this does today, is it makes your mouth smaller.
Mm.
Your mouth starts to close in. And so by the 1950s, tooth extractions, this retractive orthodontics, this is routine in the United States. This is routine across
everywhere.
The world.
Yeah.
And it's making our mouths smaller. It's giving us less room to breathe. This causes a cascade of issues. Mouths are getting compressed. After this, patients would complain about breathing difficulties, like once they got their braces removed, snoring would appear, sleep apnea, hay fever, asthma. All this stuff they'd never had before starts to appear after they've had their orthodontics work. Some started to look different. Their faces started to grow longer, flatter, and less defined. Enough showed the same breathing problems, chewing problems, and downward facial growth that in the late 1950s, a former biplane pilot and semi-professional Formula One driver and British facial surgeon, Dr. John Mew, took notice. So this guy, he's really interesting. He started measuring the faces and mouths of his patients, anyone who had gotten extractions, and then he compared them with patients who did the opposite, who got the stuff that makes your mouth bigger. And sometimes he had brothers and sisters who had done opposite treatments, or even twins who had done one treatment, the other twin had done the other treatment. Over and over again, the children who had had teeth removed and had undergone retractive orthodontics suffered the same stunted mouth. Their facial growth was all off. As they grew up, the rest of their bodies and heads grew larger and their mouths stayed the same size. This mismatch created a problem at the center of the face. The eyes would droop. Cheeks would puff up, chins would start to recess. You know that side profile look?
Oh, yeah, it's
where
awful.
Where the chin's gone?
Yeah.
That's from this.
Wow.
So this is where it's not chewing properly and not developing these muscles and everything getting out of whack. It's often due to this early orthodontic work that just stuffed everything up. The more teeth these patients had extracted, the longer they wore braces and other devices, the more obstruction seemed to develop in their airways. And Mew, this surgeon, He called this sadly a common sequel to fixed orthodontic treatment. And he found that all these devices that were trying to fix crooked teeth, they were making people's mouths small and messing up their faces. And if you were unfortunate enough to have this when you were young, as you grew up, you just looked weird.
Yeah.
You're just a weird looking person from this stuff that happened when you were a kid. Isn't this crazy? Isn't this, because we've both got kids now, isn't this scary?
It's really scary. Yeah, absolutely. Because you want to do the right thing by your kid and you want to go by conventional medicine. But when you're hearing this kind of stuff, you go, well, what am I supposed to do?
So other dentists start to back the guy up. They're seeing it every day in their practice. They're coming to the same conclusion. They start publishing scientific papers on the subject. Mew conducts his own studies. He takes hundreds of measurements before and after photos of his patients. And if you look at the before and after photos, it's mind-blowing. They look like different people. Like once you start changing the shape of the mouth, it affects everything else, like the entire look of the person's face. He even did biochemical analysis of the cell structure of the lips. Like the guy did incredible work. He went on to serve as the president of the Southern Counties branch of the British Dental Association. He had massive influence and ran a full investigation. But nobody cared. Nobody did anything.
Is that because it would be, result in too much of a change? I mean, we're all comfortable eating processed food. I mean, what's the go?
Because he was called a scammer.
What?
The mainstream, I don't know what you call it, the mainstream dentist industry.
The Snopes of dentistry.
Said he was a snake oil salesman.
Oh,
they said he was a quack. They sued him repeatedly. And eventually he lost his license.
Why is that? Would they lose money?
He was debunked, guys. Yeah. Actually, I looked this guy up and Snopes says he's full of shit, so...
No, but hang on. Why would they do that? Because obviously there has to be some type of reason for it.
Well, maybe there was money in the existing treatments. Maybe it was the status quo and people had investments in it.
Perfect. Think about it. You're talking about these tribes, you know, that haven't been affected by modern food processes or food, you know, processed foods. If they've got perfect teeth, orthodontists are out of jobs.
Yeah, but there's always going to be a problem if we're eating the same mushy diet and we're going to have those problems. But see, this is where it gets fascinating. And this is one of those examples where the experts who debunked the quack
were wrong.
They were the quacks in the end. Something really curious, he says, happened in the last few years. Hundreds of leading orthodontists and dentists have now come out in support of Mew's position. They've said that, yes, traditional orthodontics were making breathing worse in half their patients. The strongest endorsements came in April of 2018 when Stanford University Press published a 216-page monograph by famed evolutionary biologist Paul Ehrlich and Dr. Sandra Kahn, who was an orthodontist, detailing hundreds of scientific references that supported Mew's research. In a short time, Mew's outlier theories were accepted by the mainstream. Now, he speaks to another researcher, and this is where it kind of blows your mind. He says, in 10 years, nobody will be using traditional orthodontics. It's...
In 10 years?
Essentially dead, and the rest of the, you know, the community, the professional community needs to catch on. He says, we're going to look back at what was done.
As it being barbaric.
And we're going to be horrified.
Yeah.
Because it's messing up people's faces. And he actually goes, the author, James Nestor, he goes to Mew's house in the UK and he tells the story of how he sits down and he has a chat and Mew's son is there, Mike. He's also a dentist and he joins in on the conversation and he explains that, look, the first step to improving airway obstruction isn't orthodontics. It's actually maintaining correct oral posture. And anyone can do this. This is free. It just meant holding the lips together, teeth lightly touching, with your tongue on the roof of the mouth, you know, your tongue on the top of your palate. Hold the head up perpendicular to the body. Don't kink the neck. When sitting or standing, the spine should form a J shape, perfectly straight until it reaches the small of the back of the neck where it naturally curves out. And if you maintain this posture, always breathe slowly, breathe into the abdomen. You're basically, the problem's fixed. You'll train yourself to fix the problem. It'll gradually over time start correcting. And that correct breathing will actually start changing the face as well. This is the crazy thing about it.
You know what, though? The Japanese, I mean, I was joking about the Japanese before with the strips, but they've been onto this for a while because have you seen that Flappy Bird face exerciser?
Yeah.
It's actually, yeah, it's for that.
Yeah.
It's for maintaining good jaw structure.
I always thought that stuff was bullshit. But after reading this, I mean, when you actually nail the breathing and get it regular and it's part of your life, it's so fascinating that your face starts to change.
Oh, I believe that. Absolutely it does.
Like the structure of these nasal cavities starts to lose the kind of atrophied effect and you look healthier. This posture he's describing, he says if you look at any Greek statue, any drawing by Leonardo, any ancient portrait, all the subjects have this J shape. They have this posture that is perfect for the correct breath. He says, if you look around public spaces today, though, it's the opposite. Most people have shoulders hunched forward, neck extended outward, like an S-shaped spine. And he basically says, we look like a bunch of village idiots. That's what we've become. And it's killing us.
Well, it's only going to get worse, though, because as you know, we advance forward, I mean, unless there is some big change, we move towards comfort. We move towards, you know, technologies that allow us to have an easier life.
But what's fascinating is you might think of, you know, that posture of hunching over, and I do that all the time because we're on computers all the time.
Yeah.
But what actually contributes to that posture a lot isn't because you're lazy or necessarily because you're stuck in this position all day.
It's because you're a mouth breather, Ben. We get it.
It's because your tongue doesn't fit properly in your too small mouth.
No.
Yeah, because
your tongue.
Remember, all of us, we've grown up on this Western diet. We've all been eating the mushy food. We haven't been chewing properly. Our jaws haven't developed correctly. Our mouths they've grown up. Our mouths are too small. We've all got these dental problems and breathing problems. Our mouth is too small. Our tongues don't fit properly in our mouths. And having nowhere else to go, our tongue falls back into the throat, which creates this mild suffocation effect, right?
Oh, so you lean forward and kind of slouch.
So at night, what this does is you kind of attempt to push the air in and out, right?
And snoring.
But by day, we slope our shoulders, we crane our necks forward, and we tilt our heads up in this kind of instinctive way to open up this breathing passage because of the structure of our mouths and where our tongue is sitting. And this position we're in, think of the cascading effects, right?
Very much so, yeah.
It's stressing your back muscles. It leads to back pain. We get kinks in our necks, adds pressure to the brainstem, triggers headaches, neurological problems. The tilted angle of our faces stretches the skin down from our eyes. It thins the upper lip, pulls flesh down from the nasal bone. It's called cranial dystrophy. 50% of the population have this. Mark Zuckerberg has this. If you ever look at Mark Zuckerberg and you think, yes, this guy is obviously a reptilian. Like, he has reptilian eyes. But also why you're looking at him and thinking he looks weird, it's because he has this cranial dystrophy. Like, it's all his facial structure is all messed up.
Dude, just sitting there reading everyone's information all the time has obviously done this to him.
So Mike, the Muse son, actually did a YouTube video warning Zuckerberg that he was going to die 10 years earlier than usual if he didn't correct his cranial dystrophy posture.
No, he won't. He's a reptilian. They've got anti-aging technology.
Yeah, good point. I guess he didn't factor that in. So there's an exercise that he teaches so you can try and correct this. And apparently if you do, it's kind of like what the Japanese people are trying to do with their devices.
Tongue exercise.
But yeah, you do it with your tongue. Mm-hmm. And people who have done it for months claim that their jaws expanded, your jaw becomes more defined, breathe easier, no snoring, no sleep apnea.
But isn't a more square jawline something that's attractive in both sexes?
Yes, of course. Yeah,
yeah, right. Yeah. So you can see why actually, like, maybe if you could market this in a way that it makes you more attractive.
Well, he talks about this other dentist called Theodore Belfour, and I won't go into all his details because I know I've been discussing this for a while, but basically he was always told when he was doing his medical practice that you can't increase bone mass. Like after the age of 30, your bone mass starts declining.
Yeah, but you actually can, can't you? I thought that if you exercise and cause, you know, resistance and microfractures and all that kind of stuff, that you actually can cause.
Yeah, so there's been a bit of an advancement, but when he was, you know, doing his training, right. This is kind of 1960s and onwards, they were always taught, no, you can't do anything about bone mass. It just always declines. And this is why when you get into your 60s and 70s and, you know, beyond, because you're losing the bone mass in your face, everything starts to kind of sag and look weird.
Yeah.
You look like an old hack.
You end up like Cruella de Vil.
Who?
Cruella de Vil.
Yes, that person. You look like that person. And he just thought when he was, you know, seeing his patients, he thought, bullshit. Bullshit. I don't think that's true. And he developed this device that essentially, it's kind, again, it's kind of like a retainer and it increases bone mass in the jaw. And he's been doing this for years, and the author actually goes and gets one, and after a couple of months, he gets his bone mass measured before he gets this insert. And then he goes back and he gets this insert from this dentist, and his bone mass has gone up, where was it? I can't remember the measurement, but it was a significant amount of bone mass was added to the front of his face, and he started to look different. The whole structure of his face started to change. Because it was increasing bone mass.
Right, all from this device. Well,
what it's doing is it's forcing you to clench your jaw. When I was reading through this, I thought, I don't want to go see some doctor in New York and get something to shove in my face. There's got to be an easier way. And he has this little
asterisk.
He's got this little asterisk, right? And you click on the asterisk and it opens a footnote. And it says, an easier way to do this is to chew gum.
Oh, for Christ's sake, this is why.
I'll do that.
I've been sitting in the office hearing this... It's constant. It doesn't stop. It goes all day.
Yeah, so that's the other thing I ordered from Amazon is absolute...
Oh, please don't.
Shitload of gum to chew for... Because basically, a bunch of these people who have discovered this have said if you chew gum for... And it's a special type of gum. It's got to be a hard gum.
It's like sitting next to someone who's masticating a castanet. It's like...
I'm going to start doing it on the show. I thought, when am I going to fit in this gum chewing time? Perfect. 3 hours every Friday.
I've never had misophonia until now.
Just start chewing gum on the show. But apparently if you start chewing gum, it just 2 or 3 hours a day chewing hard gum, there's this hard gum you can get. It has the same effect. It starts stimulating stem cells and it starts to increase bone structure in your face and you start to correct a lot of those problems that have come from your stupid small mouth, mouth breathing.
I want some. Can you order 2 lots, please?
All right, ordered.
I'll do it as well. Yeah.
So I'll link to this book in the show notes. That's kind of the first half where he gets to the end of this explanation of why we have all these problems, why our breathing is so messed up, like why we're not doing it properly. And the second half is him going, okay, I figured out the jaw structure issue. Now I'm going to do the breathing techniques.
Okay, so that's what I want to just quickly ask you without going into too much detail. But I mean, you've put a lot of doom and gloom on the table. And I'm sure a lot of people right now are just going, holy hell, like, what am I supposed to do? But are there, apart from chewing hard gum, are there things that people can do to reverse this? I mean, even now, even though I was saying before it's like a generational thing, can you do things right now to make improvements?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the chapters was on stretches to align. It's basically similar to yoga, but you know, Qigong style exercises, stretches to align the spine, get the posture right so that the breathing improves. And the breathing has that cascading effect where it corrects a lot of those issues.
On some level though, it kind of makes sense. It makes sense that breathing is something that, you're right, I mean, we just take it for granted, but it's integral to everything. I mean, breath is life. And so you're bringing that in and you've got to make sure that you're doing it properly.
Well, it's funny. You know what this made me think of? Do you remember that book we did? The name escapes me, as it always does. But it was about ancient people being more physically capable than modern men. It was specifically about feats of men in ancient Greece.
Yeah, I remember that episode. And,
you know, the one example was there was records of the Greek rowers rowing from one part of the island to another island, you know, days away. And when they calculated the speed and the constant rate of rowing, it just would have blitzed world records we have today by, you know, threefold. And he had all these examples of how the feats of ancient men made modern men's physical feats
seem like soy boys.
Yeah, just look like weak little soy boys.
Yeah.
And I thought maybe one of the contributing factors was that ancient people
definitely
who did those incredible physical feats, they all breathed correctly.
Yep.
They all
had, you know, hard diets.
They had the proper diets.
Yep.
They had the right structure so that they could breathe correctly. So one of the biggest takeaways from this is don't breathe through your mouth.
Okay.
Stop breathing through your mouth. Train yourself not to do it. Buy a tape to put over your mouth. Breathe through your nose at night. There's tons of chapters on how when you breathe through your nose while exercising, it maintains the same amount of oxygen intake, even though you feel like you're not breathing as much. And your output kind of doubles and triples.
Are you serious? Because that's really, like, if you're running hard, it's really hard not to breathe through your
mouth. Yes. So sports scientists discovered this in the 80s. And they've done all this work with, you know, top athletes to force them to breathe through their nose constantly because it increases your performance. And again, that's another reason why the ancients would have had greater physical feats because they all breathed correctly.
Yeah.
It's huge, the ramifications that it has. So I'm looking forward to, you know, going into the second half of the book and maybe getting James on the show at a later date.
Yeah. Look, so you've been watching me. So are my nostrils inverted at the moment?
Do you have a nose boner right now?
Are they? Because I've been looking at naked pictures of Angela Merkel and I feel like my face is imploding.
Well, your whole face is flaccid now, right now.
That's what I'm saying.
Like it's melting off your face.
It's actually inverted. I feel like it's being sucked back in.
That's the Angela Merkel effect. It's well documented. There is a nude picture of Angela Merkel going around.
I know, we discussed it on the show ages ago.
Yeah, she needs something to stop her flappins from... stop them from flapping. Oh my God.
Now we're back talking about naked Angela Merkel. That's terrible.
So sorry again. Not much time left for.
I know you just. Always...
I told you that when I started reading it.
The funny thing is, look how much notes I've got here. Like I was going through today, and you come up into the office. You're like, oh, I've got only a couple of things, and then you dump that on me. And so I spent all day going through putting these stories together.
Yeah, this is fine. This is great. It means we've got a great show coming up on Friday. You've got all this stuff ready to go, locked and loaded.
I really want to tell this story. You know what? Actually, I will. I will save it. Oh, I want to tell it.
Sorry, I know you're excited about telling the UFO story.
Okay, I will hold back. We'll do it on the regular show that's coming up this week. No, we'll do it in the Plus extension, and I'll actually pad it out. Because the good thing is, I must say, when I was looking through these stories, because I ran out of time right at the end of the day, because I started translating stuff.
Oh, right.
And I was like,
translating from Russian.
Yeah, so I was using Google Translate to try and pull this stuff through. And obviously, it was like very poorly translated, because you know how terrible Google Translate is. So what I'll do is I've actually got some time then over the next couple of days to actually trawl through that properly and bring some more of these stories. And this is why I must say I do like the work that Paul does, because he's one of the very few people that are able to breach not only the language barrier, but also the cultural barrier to bring those stories out.
Some would argue he's perhaps the only person in the world that has access to the story.
Stop it with that. Look, that's a possibility. But a lot of the stuff he brings, look, I just think he's a very genuine person. So, I mean, I'm fascinated with some of the stories that he puts together. I mean, there was this one story which was really fascinating about this. Where is it? I will mention this one because I thought this one was pretty cool.
Give us a teaser.
So it relates to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist was, it was in the 1960s that was basically working with people that were suffering from, schizophrenia or other types of psychiatric conditions. And this psychotherapist noted in this particular region, this is why it's really important with the work that Paul was talking about and some of these other details have been brought forward, is that some areas, some locations across that vast landmass that was the Soviet Union and is now Russia, I mean, Russia is still a vast landmass, is that there appeared to be essentially time slip areas where people came in and out. And where this came from is because this facility that was being run with this psychiatrist, the psychiatrist started having these patients coming through. And when I say coming through, there was like three or four of them. Mm. But it became so obvious to the psychiatrist that these people that were coming in, they weren't schizophrenic. They weren't suffering from any type of mental disorder. What was happening is they were materializing. They were suddenly appearing on the streets wearing strange clothing, or they were speaking, like one was speaking, couldn't speak modern Russian, but they could speak like Russian from the 1700s, had like the dialect.
Yeah.
And what was happening is there was one particular person who was brought in. And somehow this psychiatrist pulled in someone who was knowledgeable about the older Russian tongue and was able to get the information out of this guy. And this guy was like, I don't know where I am. I'm really scared. I don't know what's happening here. Or I was out. I'd gone out and I'd been working on the field. I'm a serf to the Tsar. And I was out there working and I was digging in the field. And all of a sudden this storm came over. And when this storm came over, I passed out. And when I woke up, I was lying on this material, this strange material. He was lying on the road. He was found lying on the road. And it seems like he'd been propelled 200 years into the future.
What the hell?
After encountering a storm. A time storm.
Time storms!
Like what Jenny Randles has done a lot of research into. But this is coming from the Soviet report. Now, of course, the reason why these details came through was that this psychiatrist went and reported it because obviously it was, you know, communist, you know, Soviet state. Mm. And what he did is he reported it.
Yeah, that kind of sucks. You travel to 200 years in the future.
I know, and you end up there.
Communism.
Well, this is the thing.
Why is everyone starving?
Well, what's really stunning about this is that he takes the, he goes and reports it, as you're supposed to, being a good communist. And when he reported it, these strange men in black-like figures showed up. And when I say men in black, it wasn't because they were men in black. They were just government officials that showed up. And the government officials seemed to just accept that, yeah, this happens quite frequently, we understand.
We've got another one. Throw him in the time gulag.
Yeah, pretty much. And this psychiatrist was convinced that what was going on is that there was some type of time portal or some type of geographical feature of this particular area, which was transporting people through. So it was still a natural phenomena and it was projecting people in. And the government, the Soviet government, knew about it. And they may have actually had a facility where they were taking these people to try and find out what was happening with them.
Cut them open and see how they
think. That was never implied, but I did wonder about that. I thought, how far will you go? But the reason why this one particular story stood out so well is because after he told his story and it was translated and the guy calmed down and, you know, they realized that this guy was from 200 years in the past, is that they put him into a locked room. You know, much like any psychiatric hospital, they put him into not a padded room, but a locked room. And there was no way in or out, except when they went to find the guy, he was gone. So it almost like he'd dematerialized or he'd gone past a
time jumped.
Yeah, it's odd. So it's like, the strange thing is it seems like the opening has to be a fixed location. To come through, it's a fixed location. But once you've come through and it's like you're out of your time.
You're still attached to your timeline.
Yeah, and it's like a rubber band and you suddenly get flung back.
That makes sense.
Yeah, so I thought that was pretty fascinating. So those are the kind of stories that I started digging through and I will go into more detail. There was one actually that I got more insight into and I mentioned this story on the show a while back, but the details are quite fascinating because it related to a group of students in Leningrad and these students had rented out a holiday home, this house. This house had been abandoned for 30 years. And if you recall, what happened was is that they were in the house doing what good Soviet students would do, I suppose. So it was no crazy parties. They were probably just studying. But they heard this banging going on downstairs in the basement. And they refused to go into the basement because the basement had this sulfurous smell coming from it. Again, sulfur pops up in a lot of paranormal phenomena. With this smell that was coming through, and the banging, they decided, well, we have to go downstairs now. So they kind of opened the door to the basement and they tiptoed down the stairs a little bit to look. And in the darkness, they could see this man, this middle-aged, you're not too old man, that was fumbling about in the darkness. So like, oh, it's some guy. I mean, how did he get into the house? So they went downstairs and they had a lantern, like they had a lit lantern, as in like one with a naked flame. And they hand the lantern to him because he's like, who are you people? And they said, well, we're students. We've rented this house. And he's like, oh, I don't have time for that. I don't have time for that. Where are the pickles? Where are the pickles? And he was stumbling about looking for these jars of pickles. He claimed that there were jars of pickles. Now, of course, there was none there. So they gave him the lantern and then went back up the stairs. And they said that the lantern just disappeared. Like it was gone.
Yeah.
With him. He took the lantern with him. So they went and got another second lantern and went down there. And there was no way in or out apart from up those stairs. This was the only way he could get through. So they're all a bit shocked. And what they knew is that the guy that owned this house had disappeared 30 years prior. So the kicker to this story, though, which is really fascinating, is that apparently they were all disturbed by what had just happened because they thought that they'd seen a ghost. So they went outside and the neighbors were like, well, what are you doing out here? And were asking questions to them. And they said, look, they just described the story that I described to you. And the neighbor, this elderly woman, comes out because she overheard what was happening. She was sitting in a window watching and she comes down. And she says, tell me what he looked like. And they're like, well, he had, you know, the gray hair, and but it wasn't too gray. And it was like kind of thinning. And, you know, he had short and this kind of, and described his physical attributes of this man that they saw looking for pickles. And she went white. And the reason why she went white is she says, I have lived here for 60 years of my life. 30 years ago, the man you're describing, who was the owner of that house, disappeared. and no one knows what happened to him. He just disappeared. He vanished. They were never able to find another trace of him after he'd been hanging around in his home, though. So it's almost like he'd been projected forward 30 years.
Yeah, weird.
And then left and gone somewhere else. Who knows where he went? And of course...
Did he find his pickles, though?
Well, this is the thing. So she added to it that, yeah, he used to jar pickles. He used to jar foods. That's what he did. And down in the basement was essentially his larder. That's where he would store all the food. So an incredible story of these strange time aberrations and temporal anomalies that, you know, we hear about them happening in the West. But I guess the reason why I like Paul's work is because, you know, you've got this coming from a different culture with a different language, you know, hidden behind the Iron Curtain for so long, but it demonstrates that this phenomenon is not localized to one nation. Yep. It's a worldwide phenomenon, which of course makes sense. It makes absolute sense that this is something that would happen. But it means that I wonder if there's a whole heap of other stories that we just don't hear, like from Japan or from, you know, Africa, where those stories haven't seeped through yet. They haven't, you know, kind of in a form of osmosis traveled through. So I think that this is really fascinating stuff, and I will go into more of these kinds of stories, particularly what the military was involved with on the Plus Extension coming up on this Thursday.
Cool. That's coming up on...
Friday, sorry. Yes.
Why'd you say Thursday?
I don't know. I'm just brain fog at the moment. My kid isn't sleeping at...
That's it's called dyslexia.
It's not dyslexia.
It's been complaining about headaches, getting the show numbers back to front.
Yes, because I've got brain fog at the moment, I've been getting the show numbers back to front, and you've been accusing me of dyslexia.
Maybe you're not breathing correctly.
Yes, because breathing not correctly causes you to put your numbers back to front. Maybe.
There's another book I'm going to link to in the show notes called Jaws, The Story of a Hidden Epidemic, which is the book I read years ago.
That was actually really disturbing. I remember you telling me some of those details, and that was...
Well, that book has all the pictures.
Yeah.
So in the show notes, have a look at the before and afters. You can get what I'm talking about with the how the face changes. It's kind of scary. But yeah, make sure you check out Breath, The New Lost Science, or The New Science of a Lost Art by James Nestor. That's available now as an audio version as well. And that's a wrap for this Plus Edition. Thanks for being members. We'll catch you on Friday for your next MU. Until then, have a great week.